Hey everyone, welcome to the latest edition of the Front Judge Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. Now this week I'm joined by my colleague at FrontJudge.com, Mike Neff, as well as Joey Gase, who finished a career-high 18th in Sunday's Monster Energy NASCAR Cup Series race at Talladega Super Speedway. But before we get started, I wanted to remind you on how you can sign up for the podcast every week. Subscribe to the Front Judge Podcast on iTunes, and you'll get it sent straight to your smartphone once it's published. And once you do, be sure to stop by iTunes and leave us a review, as 5-star ratings helps us out tremendously. Now let's go to Joey Gase. All right, Joey, you finished career-high 18th this past weekend in the Cup Series at Talladega and 28 career starts total in the series. Overall, take us through your weekend with Starcom.
Yeah, it was a pretty good weekend. We didn't have a backup car or anything like that, so we took it easy in practice and then did too many laps. And actually, in those few laps we did, we got a flat left rear tire, which was almost a disaster. But luckily, I was able to get it slowed down fast enough and not lose control, and we were able to limp it back in without really getting any damage. So that was lucky and unlucky all at the same time. So that was good. And then qualifying, we knew we were in the show, and we did a lap and put it in. And then once the race started, we did whatever we could to stay in the draft the entire time and on the lead lap. And we tried to be smart and make sure we didn't get involved in anything. And luckily, we were able to do all those things. The only accident we got in was on the very last lap in the turn one. We were right in the middle of it, and we just got a little bit of nose damage. But we were able to bring it home in one piece for the most part in 18th, which was my best career finish yet in the Cup Series, and also the best finish Starcom has gotten yet. So that was pretty cool to be able to do that for those guys and our sponsor, the PFK Foundation. And it was also a great points day for the team, which was really good for them as well.
Yeah, and it's funny that you said backup car, because a lot, you know, chatter during the weekend was Bubba Wallace and him saying that he doesn't have a backup car. Obviously, you're running for a little bit of a smaller team with Starcom, but what was your opinion on the whole backup car? Because obviously, you don't want to get the backup car out.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, we didn't have a backup car, but I mean, you never want to get it out. And most of the small teams at the super speedways, you'll see, play it pretty smart, and they don't really do much drafting or any drafting at all during practice, and they'll just make sure their car runs and goes and the attitude is okay and go from there, because they can't take any chances. But like you said, people are making a big deal that Bubba didn't have a backup car, which, I mean, a team his size should have one, but there's a lot of teams out there, I would say probably 30th on back and order points, that probably don't have a backup car, or if they do, it's probably not completely put together. So it's something that a lot of the small teams have to deal with a lot of the time.
So wait a second, you don't have, I mean, when you say don't have a backup car, you just like don't have a Speedway backup car? You did not have a backup car at all?
We did not have a Speedway backup car, and I mean, we didn't have a backup car, period, in the hauler. We just did not have one, so if we...
Really?
Luckily, yeah, I mean, that's I'd say a lot of the small teams actually probably don't have a Speedway backup car at all, at least at that point in the season.
Interesting, because I know I've been friends with people that try to do like one-off races, and NASCAR required them to have a backup car as well as their primary car. So I wonder what the logic is as to when they require that and when they don't. That's good to hear. I'm going to have to inquire about that.
That's interesting, because I don't know how NASCAR can make that mandatory or how they would ever know, unless they physically went up into right. A hauler and check, yeah. Which I've never seen them do that before.
Now, so. Joey, I got a question on plate racing in general, because over the past 2 years, specifically, you know, you've run a lot of cup races in cup, and you have a best finish of 5th in the Xfinity Series at Talladega. Overall, do you just enjoy plate racing?
Yeah, I do. I mean, the cool thing about plate racing is it's, I mean, I won't say any car on the track, but if you got an okay car and a car that handles and can draft well, it's anyone's game, and you can get a good finish. And I've been able to prove that multiple times, luckily, throughout my career in the Xfinity Series, and we did a decent job last weekend in the Cup Series. So I enjoy that, and a lot of people see what I've been able to do off on the speedways, which obviously helps me get in the seat, and then also the sponsors see that as well, which helps obviously a ton. So it's a little bit of all the above, I guess you can say.
Neff, you got anything?
Yeah, Joe, and you talk about how the plate races kind of equal the playing field a little bit. I'm curious, as you've taken your first glances at the 2019 rules package, do you feel like that's going to give you guys a better shot, not necessarily for wins, but maybe to be a little more competitive and have more lead lap finishes than you have in the past?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely, it's not going to hurt by any means, that's for sure. I think it's definitely can help the small teams a little bit with the new rules package. I mean, it's not, I don't think it's going to be like it is, you know, at Daytona or Talladega. It's not going to be as big as an equalizer as that. You're still going to have your car handle, and you're still going to have the horsepower, stuff like that for sure, which that's one thing too, that small teams, a lot of times when they go to the super speedway, they'll take their best shot at it there and try to, if they have to spend a little bit more money to lease a motor or get a good motor, they'll do it at the super speedways because they know they got a good shot of doing well there, where obviously they can't afford to do that every week. So it's I think it's still definitely going to be an equalizer. If you can hang on to the draft on that type of racing, it's definitely going to help you. And honestly, anytime you slow the cars down, it's going to bring everyone a little bit closer together. That's just the way everything works. So I think it's definitely a good thing for the smaller teams. And you can also see more wrecks, too. Obviously, if the small teams aren't in the draft, it's going to help them out. So it's as far as I see it, kind of being an advantage every way around for the small guys.
And I'm interested, you know, like you said, you were in the lead pack there for a little bit on Sunday. But when you see like a team, an organization as big as Storehouse Racing, they have this mindset going into the race where they're going to work together regardless of the circumstances. How does that change your mindset as a driver?
As far as, like, if you'd be in a Stuart Haas situation?
No, for you, like, competing against him.
I mean, honestly, there's really nothing we can do about it. I mean, when they're up front and they're the fastest cars on the track and they decide to work together and just stay single file the whole race, there's nothing really we can do about it. So it doesn't really, I guess, change your mindset that much because there's nothing you can really do about it. Next to them, and you're able to break them up maybe out of the draft. Other than that, there's really nothing you can do as a driver, and you just keep going out there and doing what you can. And I guess you can say running the second race.
The second race, I like that phrase, Zach. That when it was getting down to the end there before that final caution, that was exactly what it was. It was four and everybody else. Speaking of second races and races coming up, how you feeling about your chances when you roll into Kansas this weekend?
I'm feeling pretty good about it. I like Kansas Speedway, and it's one of the tracks I've probably had the most starts at. And it's kind of almost like a home race for me, being from Iowa, Chicago, and in Kansas Speedway are definitely the closest Cup Series tracks that we go to, so we'll have a lot of friends and family down there. So I'm looking forward to it, and I think we should have a good car down there.
Yeah, we got a couple more for you, Joey, as we know your time's limited tonight. But I want to chat a little bit about the Xfinity Series, because before the year, you made the jump to Go Green Racing, and we talked after the first Bristol race where you had a career best then, four consecutive top 20s in a row. Now, obviously, the season's got four races left, winding down very rapidly. How would you assess the year as a whole?
I think it's been a good year. I wouldn't say it's been a great year, but it's definitely been the best year I've had yet in my career. And we're continuing to build, and hopefully we'll be able to finish the year off strong and get better yet. We've learned a lot as a team and learned about each other and figuring out the cars and stuff like that. So it's been a good year. I don't know how many top 20s I've had, but I know it's been more I've ever had in my career as a total until this year happened. So that's been awesome, and we've been able to get two top 15 finishes so far, and hopefully we can get a couple more of those. So it's been a good year, being more competitive and racing against, you know, Clements and the Siegs and those guys like that who, I mean, that's as close as you can get to the, you know, the top of the field without being in a top funded car. So to be able to do that's been a lot of fun, and hopefully we'll be able to beat those guys here in this next couple races.
Yeah, and I know after your scrimmage with Ross Chastain at Mid-Ohio, you mentioned that this was your best season so far because, you know, there's been more money pouring into it because you got a bigger sponsor than usual or past season. So overall, being, you know, racing for a smaller team, how has having that sponsor and that money helped you as a driver?
I mean, it's helped a lot. I mean, I've been able to be in better equipment because of the more sponsorship we have because of that. And, I mean, Archie taking me underneath his wing a little bit. And, I mean, before, you know, I would come in for pit stops, and it'd be very rare to be able to put a sticker tires on, where now we're able to put sticker tires on every time and stuff like that, where we still don't have the newest cars out there. Our race cars normally are about 4 or 5 years old that we're running, and we have good motors, but we don't have the best motors. We're not able to lease our motors every week like the top guys are, or their company already makes their motors. So it's definitely been good to be able to make that step, and that would be awesome sometime in my career to be able to make that full step and getting the best equipment out there. But I'm very thankful for what I have, and I can't thank Sparks Energy enough and Archie and everyone at Go Green Racing for giving me this opportunity, and all the other sponsors that have come on for this year as well, such as Adzeroka and all the other Donate Life organizations and ProMaster and many, many other guys that team up with us. It's awesome to see how much support and how many friends we've had been able to gain throughout the years, and just looking forward to hopefully continue that.
Neff, you got a final one for Joey, and then I'll ask one final one.
One quickie that's got nothing to do with NASCAR. Did you ever run the Super Nationals in Boone, Iowa?
I haven't. It's definitely a place I would like to go and race sometime, but a lot of people assume with being from Iowa that I was a big dirt racer, but actually I wasn't. Being from Cedar Rapids, we had the only asphalt track in the state besides Iowa Speedway, which is Hawkeye Downs, and that's where my dad raced at when I was growing up. So that's just what I automatically started to do when Landon Castle was actually in the same shoes. We're both from Cedar Rapids, and that's where we grew up racing for the most part, was Hawkeye Downs Speedway.
And so, Joey, in that same conversation after Bristol, we'll get you out here in this one, by the way. In that same conversation, you mentioned to me that your goal for next year was to be full-time in the Cup Series. Now, I won't ask you if you have a ride or what, you know, what your future holds, but have there been conversations now that the 32's open and obviously Archie's your owner?
Yeah, I've been having conversations with a bunch of people, and especially Archie. So I don't have anything that stone yet or anything I can announce, but we're definitely working hard on trying to be able to be full-time hopefully next year in the Cup Series, or the very least hopefully next Xfinity Series. But that's definitely my goal still, is to be full-time in the Cup Series, and I think we're hopefully getting close to that.
Well, cool, man. Thanks for taking some time out of your day to review Talladega, and have a good weekend. Good luck this weekend in Kansas.
Okay, thank you so much, guys.
Yep.
Take care, brother.
All right, Neff, always good to have drivers on, as we've talked about in the past. Joey Gase this year, you know, he's had an outbreak year for him in the Xfinity Series. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on him this year in the 35 car?
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool. I mean, Joey's one of those guys that you always see his name on the list, but the only time you ever really seem to see him is when he's backwards in the grass in the infield or something. And yet you don't see that as often now as you did the last year or two. And it, like he said, he's had his best season so far in top 20s. And that means he's running at the end and he's running on lead laps. And it's a matter of sometimes it takes a while just to figure out how to race and how to get to the end of these races. And I know the Xfinity races are shorter than Cup races, and it's a little different mindset, but there's still a means to the end. And I feel like Joey came in raw and tore some stuff up simply because he was racing hard because he's a racer. And I feel like now he's kind of started to figure out the means to the end, and he's getting better finishes, and I hope that that continues to open doors for him as he gets on to the next level.
Yeah, and I think it could, because much like this year where you see drivers like Matt DiBenedetto, Ryan Preece, they bet on themselves. Joey bet on himself, maybe to a lesser degree, you know, not going to that big team, but he's still running the full year. So last year, ironically enough, I was going into Kansas Speedway, he announced that he was leaving Jimmy Means Racing, where he had been for 4 or 5 years, you know, starting part-time back in 2012. And last year, he bet on himself, so then he found this opportunity over the offseason with Go Green and Archie St. Hilaire, and obviously that's affiliate of the 32 Cup car, which right now is driven by Matt DiBenedetto, but it's wide open for next year. But looking at his stats, last year he had 2 top 10s, but he only had 5 top 20s. And like I mentioned, you know, I asked him about the top 20 streak, and he had 4 consecutive at one point this year, really early on in the season, and he has 12 so far in 29 races. So obviously a big increase in performance, and it's only going to get better, I would imagine.
Absolutely, I think so. And like you said, if he gets that shot to 32, yeah, it's not winning races, but in that race, and we've talked about this numerous times with the different folks that we've had on, there's the race for the top 20 or top 15-ish, and then there's that race for 25th on back. And that 32 car is usually at the front of that race for 25th on back. And to get in there gives you an opportunity to showcase your talents a little more than a car that's been finishing back closer to, you know, 30th, 33rd. I think if he can get in there, I think he could do some things.
Yeah, I mean, he's run 28 Cup races in the last 5 years. So he's got almost a full year of experience. Obviously, all the smaller teams, but the 32 is a smaller team too. So, we don't know who's going to get that 32. He just said that he doesn't know yet, though there have been conversations. So I guess we'll see in the coming weeks here as the season winds down. But Neff, did you watch Talladega? I'd imagine you probably did.
Of course I did.
I'll just ask you, what were your thoughts on that race?
The first 160 laps, give or take, was horrendously boring. And the last 27 or 37, whatever we ended up running there, was slightly boring. As Talladega races go, that was honestly one of the worst ones I think I've ever seen.
Same.
You had the, thank God for the fuel mileage excitement, or it would have been the 4 Stewart Haas cars up front, which, God love them, they deserve the credit on it, because they came out and put an ass whipping on the rest of the field. So that there's, you know, no disparaging remarks whatsoever to Stewart Haas. They came and kicked ass. But it was just from a racing standpoint, I was disappointed, because I'm sitting here looking at the last quote-unquote restrictor plate race at Talladega, where restrictor plates were born, and we get nobody running side-by-side for 100-plus laps. And it was just totally uninspiring. And I really thought that with it not being an elimination race and with it being a last plate race, we were going to get some people to actually take some chances. And nobody took any chances. And that's why, in all reality, nothing happened over the last 20 or so laps until that last caution, because nobody took any chances early, so they didn't figure out how to get runs to get to the front. And so you had the top four just slowly driving away, and everybody else back there trying to push and shove and do whatever they were trying to do, and nobody could get a run because they hadn't figured out how to do it over the first 140 laps. So it was just frustrating to me, because I felt like some people were really going to go out and race and see what they could do, and it ended up being the Stewart Haas cars putting on a dominant performance and everybody else just riding around like, we'll just follow them, and at the end, we'll see what we can do, and then they couldn't do anything.
Yeah, it was an ass-whooping indeed. I think there were cars that were capable of running with them. Obviously, you know, it's a plate race, so that last restart, like, if that... But there was other restarts, too, so I don't know. It just... It was one of the... I'll say it. One of the worst plate races I've ever seen. And they're supposed to be entertaining, and for a lot of that race, probably at, over half at least, like you said, probably over 100 laps, single-file racing. And that's because they're just trying to keep up with the front four, because they had the fastest cars. They were fastest in practice. They had the four fastest qualifying laps, not just by a little bit. Kurt Busch had 0.2 on the field. So, yeah. they hands down had the best cars, the fastest cars. But... I guess what saved it is the fuel mileage. And also, maybe you could say Eric Almirola, who you predicted last week would go to victory lane. Enough. The racing gods have a funny way of working out.
Finally. Dude, I've been predicting him all year. You know that. But I feel glad for him. And I really feel glad for those number 10 team just guys.
Yeah.
I mean, because there's some guys with that team that have been there since... They did the move because Tony Gibson, when he went over to do the 41, took all of his guys with him. And as far as I know, that's still primarily the 41 crew. But from that move, those guys that are on the 10 now have never been to Victory Lane. And that number 10 car has gone a long time with a lot of attention on it and no wins. And now this year... Almirola's had at least 3 wins taken away between the wreck at Daytona, the yellow at New Hampshire, and then the yellow at Dover. I mean, those were easily, or not easily, 2 of those were easily going to be wins. The Daytona one was up in air. But, I mean, he should be sitting on 3 or 4 wins this year. And imagine how much even more dominant Stuart Haas would look now. Because they've got 11 wins now. Which is more than a third of the races that have been run this year have been won by Stuart Haas cars. And I don't think they're done. So it spoke volumes of the state of where the sport is right now. And I don't think you're going to see 4 Stuart Haas cars at Homestead, but I think 2 is a pretty good bet, and 3 is not out of the question.
And that would be something. We've never seen that before, 3 from the same team in the final 4. But as far as Almirola, you hit the nail on the head. I was looking at his stats, and this year he's at 181 laps. So in 31 races, at 181 laps. In the 10 years prior, which a few of them are part-time, he had 176. So I know that was obviously with lesser equipment, whether it be Richard Petty Motorsports or even DEI back in the day. But it's crazy how much of a turnaround this is, because for years we didn't expect anything out of that 10 car. Granted, you know, the driver had a lot to do with it, being Danica. And that's not a shot at her, it's just the truth. I mean, you put Eric in a car and he's going to get the most out of it, as we've seen this year. Sometimes he goes over the edge, which sometimes is what you want. But, I mean, it's about time he got into victory lane, and, you know, now all 4 Stuart Haas cars have a win. But... I don't know. I saw something on NASCAR.com that I wanted to get your take on. They had a piece where they thought that, well, it was an opinion piece, about Stuart Haas Racing being the best organization of all time in a given year. And I threw this on you, so last minute just now, so you might not have an answer right off the top of your head, but, I mean, we got Clint Bowyer, Kevin Harvick, Kurt Busch, Eric Almirola, 2 past champions. Bowyer finished 2nd in the points in 2012. And Almirola, I mean, this is the best opportunity ever. So what are your thoughts on that? Is it the best team ever? I would argue no.
That's a bold statement. When you consider you had a time there where Jimmy Johnson and Jeff Gordon were teammates.
That's what I'm saying.
They were winning a lot of races.
That's what I'm saying. I would say no.
And not to mention, you go back to the days of Petty Enterprises. Now, I don't know if this was couched as modern era or not. Because Petty Enterprises back in the 50s and 60s was truly dominant. Not to mention when you had the years with Carl Kiekhafer, which, again, we're going back to early 50s. But, yeah, Joe Weatherly and Flock, they won like half the races between those two cars. And this was back when they were running 50-something races. I mean, they dominated the sport without question. Now, mind you, they had the most financial backing, and, you know, it was one of those deals, but we've seen that since the first two cars raced each other. The one with more money behind it probably won, because that's how racing works. The more money you spend, I forget if it was Smokey Unick or Holman and Moody that said, you can go as fast as your wallet will let you. I mean, the faster, the more money you can spend, the faster you can go. And that's the way this sport kind of works, although it has leveled out some with the rule book that is some 400 and some pages long. Mm-hmm. But you've still got, I mean, as an organization of post-1972, I still don't know that I would go there, because some of Junior Johnson's teams back when he was running with Darrell Waltrip and Bill Elliott and guys like that, I mean, they were the dominant team in the sport. So I'll buy that it's of the last year, yeah. But other than that, I don't know that I'm going to go far beyond that, because it's as cyclical as this sport is. You get teams that go on runs. I mean, don't forget, not that long ago, that's why we have a rule about four teams being owned by an owner now, because Jack Roush had five teams that were beating the crap out of everybody. So, yeah, I don't know that I'm going to go out on that branch very far from the trunk at all.
And I don't even think we have to go back 3 years. Joe Gibbs Racing in 2015 lit it up. And that was even with Kyle missing the first 11 races of the year. He won five and obviously en route to the championship. Kenseth won five, Edwards won two, and Denny Hamlin won two. So that's 14. I mean, if you're going just by wins alone, that's 14's greater than 11. But yeah, I'm with you. Obviously, you know, way back in the day, I'm a NASCAR historian, so back in the day you had Penske Enterprises. But even in the last decade, you had Hendrick Motorsports with Gordon, Johnson. You had Mark Martin winning a bunch of races there. So yeah, I would say there's been more stacked teams than Stuart Haas this year, but that's not to take anything away from Stuart Haas. They've had an incredible year. Like you said, they've won more than a third of the races so far, and all four of them are in pretty good shape going into the next round, into the final race of this round. They're all by over 21 points, and then Harvick and Almirola are clinched. So
yeah, the only one I think has any worries right now is Bowyer.
Yeah, he's
Bowyer's 21 points up.
Yep.
And you don't want to feel like there's added pressure being in Kansas, but let's face it, he's from Kansas. So try, and Clint may seem like a goofball. Well, Clint is a goofball. But even saying that, when he gets behind the wheel, he is as determined as anybody.
Yes.
And when he gets to the track Friday and Saturday, he is going to be full on trying to do the best that he can to win in advance. So I feel like he's going to have some distractions from being in Kansas, but I don't know that it's going to kill him. But at the same time, I feel like that is going to be a little added pressure. And if it comes down to a 1 or 2 point deal, that could be what bites him. I still think the one I'm looking at out of all the guys on the bottom, I don't think Bowman's got a shot in hell. But I honestly think Martin Truex Jr. is not going to advance. I just feel like it's falling apart for them. They have looked lost the last couple three races.
I mean, I would say the Roval there are pretty good. Probably should have won. But, yeah, I mean, Talladega, where the hell were they? You didn't even know they were in the field, honestly. They're in the 20s all day, 30s at some points. Yeah, Dover, they were average at best.
Yeah, they were pretty junky.
Yeah, and so that's a good point. He's 18 to the good right now. He's got a lot of recent success at Kansas, which may bode well for him. But maybe not. Maybe not as well.
Yeah, because he just always seemed to have that one surprise that falls out.
Larson, you know, last year.
There's usually the three guys that are like, yeah, they weren't going to make it. And unfortunately, I feel like Larson's that way this year. Just based on his post-Talladega comments, I feel like there's too much turmoil going on there for them to get it all back together and go run and win a race, especially from what I understand at the last tire test that went on out there, every single person was running the wall.
Yeah.
So when they take that line away from Larson, I've seen him run really well by going to the bottom, you know, contrarian, but at the same time, I feel like it's just I don't think like it's going to line up for him this time.
Yeah, I want to hit on those comments here in a second. But last year going into Kansas, Larson had a 29-point advantage and blew an engine, and, you know, he didn't make the final eight. So
right. It
is possible for, like, say, Kurt Busch, who I don't know where he is on the chart right now, but he's 30 points up, that if he has, you know, a blown engine, that's going to lose you a lot of points, especially with the stages nowadays. But you hit on Kyle Larson there, and I found his comments very intriguing about – he kind of took a really big shot at Chip Ganassi Racing. I would call it an open hand slap, to be honest with you, saying how they really haven't invested any money and time into the restrictor plate program since he started in 2014. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, so I like Kyle Larson's honesty. I always have. It can look at you the bad way, or look at people the bad way. Give the people a bad opinion of him, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But it's blunt and it's honest, and that's journalists, that's what we like. I mean,
absolutely.
So, I mean, I respect him for what he says, and there's got to be some truth to it. I mean, they were 1.7 seconds off in qualifying.
Restrictor plate racing is something that you embrace or tolerate. Because in the grand scheme of things, it only matters because of the Daytona 500 and the elimination race in the playoff. You've got four plate races during the year that are crapshoots. And you get people like Richard Childress Racing, who honestly, I don't know that they're putting any money into it anymore. Dale Earnhardt Incorporated, that was the thing. That was why ECR engines evolved, was because Dale Earnhardt and Richard Childress were bound and determined to win all four plate races every year. And so they put a tremendous amount of time, effort, and money into winning those four races. And they did it a lot. And there's benefit to it because, like it or not, those four races are pretty much the four most watched races of the season, barring maybe Homestead. Maybe the Bristol Night Race, although anymore, I don't know if that's even up there. But the plate races are the ones that draw the most attention, so it gives you a bigger bang for your buck to go out and try and get sponsors. But in the grand scheme of things, that one race at Talladega and the Daytona 500 are the only two that really matter of plate races. And we've seen some pretty crappy teams finish right up front in some of these plate races. So I understand where Larson's coming from, but I also can understand where Chip Ganassi's coming from.
Right.
That you have a budget, and you have a budget to go out and try and win a championship, and you've got, and I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but it's like 15 or 17 races on mile-and-a-half intermediate tracks. Let's spend, you know, 80% of our budget on winning those when there's five of those in the playoffs, versus spending 40% of your budget to try to win four races. So I understand Larson's frustration because you're going out there taking a knife to a gunfight, but I understand Ganassi's point, hey, let's go win a championship and not worry about those. And it's the same mentality back to road racing. Most of the time, the teams would bring an old Martinsville car to run road races and just go out there and put in the laps and get it done with. But now that road racing has become so popular, the drivers have all figured out how to do it to where they can all actually win. And again, they've become more highly rated, so you're getting more eyeballs on it, which is making it a little easier to sell sponsorship. You start chasing those road race cars a little bit more as well. So that's tough to say because now that we have 2.5 road races, I can see where that's going to be a tough decision for Ganassi to swallow as well, because you got to decide, do you want to go for it? Because and looking at that, I mean, yeah, McMurray had a decent run on the Roval, but in the grand scheme of things, I don't know that Ganassi's been that strong on the road courses for a while. And it used to be that was one of the races that you always thought McMurray had a shot at.
Yep.
And anymore, I don't know that they're that in contention on it. So I think I understand Larson's point, and I don't blame him for being frustrated, but when you're looking at it from the grand picture of it all, I don't know that you want to put that many eggs into that small of a basket.
Yeah, you hit on a lot of points there, but I'm glad you brought up McMurray, especially because when you look at his career, I mean, he's never won on a road course, but play racing's his best type of racing there is, I think. He's won what? Twice at Daytona and twice at Talladega. And so that's four of his eight career wins. And he always used to be up towards the front. He's very aggressive. But he finished second there at Talladega last May of 2017. But over the past couple of years, he's been out to lunch when it comes to plate racing. And it must be, you know, it comes down to the budget, which we don't think about with plate racing. But Joey Gase even hit about it on earlier about how you can smaller teams can invest more money into the plate races because they actually have a shot of running towards the front. So, yeah, it's...
I'm dying to make some phone calls after this week and find out the story on this backup deal because I know a couple different teams that were running, like, trying to do some one-off races 3 or 4 years ago and were told that they had to have a backup car in their hauler that was fit to race.
Yeah.
And to have multiple people saying this weekend they did not have a backup car, I find very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and the reason that came to fruition and why it's a big deal is because Friday in Bubba Wallace's press conference at Talladega, he said he didn't have a backup car. And that's, you know, they're what, 28th, 29th in points somewhere around there? And, yeah. I mean, they have a decent-sized budget, probably a lot bigger than StarCom. And for them not to have a backup car is kind of really interesting, but Bubba made it a big joke on Twitter all week saying how he didn't need it. I think he finished 19th or something like that and stayed out of trouble. It's his first top 20 finish in like 12 races or something. So evidently he didn't need the backup car. But I want to get back on track here because someone else who didn't need the backup car was Kurt Busch. He ran out of gas, obviously, on the final corner in turn four. Upset after the race, and I think rightfully so, Neff. NASCAR used, I think it was 5 pace laps after the final caution for a 3-car pileup, knowing that many teams were close on fuel to making it because a lot of teams didn't pit for like, I think it was 50 to go or something, 49 to go. And on the final lap, they didn't throw a caution going into turn one when there was a crash. When the day prior, there was a crash on the backstretch on the final lap of the truck race, and they did throw a caution. So, Neff, I mean, what? Where's the consistency here?
Welcome to NASCAR, my friend. This has been a debate since God invented yellow flags, I think. I mean, I liked it. I was glad they didn't throw the caution on the final lap. We saw that 2, maybe 3 years ago, cost Dale Jr. a win at Talladega because they threw a caution on it with Logano out in front of him. And we've seen other guys have the same thing. I mean, Mark Martin should have had the Daytona 500, and they didn't throw a caution. So it's that ongoing debate, and I applaud NASCAR for trying to finish the race under green. They had a big wreck, but all of the cars were off of the racing surface. I think all but 2 of them continued on after the wreck. I think the 32 and one other one were the only ones that stopped after the wreck, but both of them had their window nets down and they could tell that the drivers were moving around. And so they chose to leave it green and let it run. The bigger complaint for me, as Kurt pointed out, was the extra caution lap.
Yeah.
And I know Dale Jr. Commented on it after the race, or it might have even been the next day. But whatever it was, he was saying, and NASCAR will be more than happy to explain to Kurt why they ran that lap. I'd love to hear the explanation because I see it all the time and it infuriates me, especially even more so than that, which in all honesty, I thought there should have been a red flag. As soon as that wreck happened, you knew there was going to be a cleanup of more than a lap. They should have red flagged it again, knowing everybody was close on fuel, but we see it all the time with red flags. There will be a red flag. They'll come back and run 3 more caution laps before they go green. There is no excuse for that. You had your whole red time to get everything squared away. You should fire off, come by the start-finish line, and go green the next time by. but we have all the time burn those extra laps. And it's crazy, and especially in Talladega. A caution lap at Talladega is like 9 minutes.
2.6 miles, too. That's a lot of gas.
There's no reason for it to take 5 laps to clean that thing up. So, yeah, I think Busch had every right to be pissed. I'd have been pissed, and I'd have gone down and said, yeah, show me why you had to run that extra lap. Because I feel like it was unnecessary by any stretch that they should have gone 5 caution laps under that 3-car wreck.
Yeah, I'm with you on this one. I don't get why they didn't throw the red flag. You look at last week at Dover, and they had a red flag after a caution in an overtime start. I mean, where's the consistency with these yellow red flags? What is a red flag nowadays? You know, what qualifies as it? The truck race. Now that one, I didn't think they were gonna. I thought they were gonna throw the caution for the cup race. I didn't think they were gonna throw the caution for the truck race. I was wrong on both accounts. Because of the truck race, the wreck happened halfway down the backstretch, and I get that Noah Gregson, you know, he got airborne. He didn't flip, but he got airborne. So it was a pretty big hit, pretty big crash. But I just don't. And you see drivers like, you know, how Kurt Busch was pissed off. So was Ryan Blaney. And he's usually even keel. He doesn't have a temper or an attitude problem, and he was pissed off. Yep. So I just don't know where this is going to lead to. I don't know what NASCAR can do. There's got to be some kind of template or something about, maybe it's track to track too. I don't know.
It's a hard call. Don't get me wrong. And again, this is another one of those things that has been promised forever. And I still wait for it to finally happen. They have told us for years that they're going to let the media go up into race control for a race so that we can sit there alongside them and see the decisions made and why the decisions are made. And I have begged for that for 13 years, I think. And they keep telling us it's going to happen, but it never happens. So I don't know why, but it is what it is. But yeah, it is hard. Trust me. I've been in race control at local short tracks many times, and you're trying to take in information from multiple sources at the same time. And we've talked about that on this show before, too, about getting rid of the side skirts and the air going under the cars and the absolute paranoia of NASCAR about cars getting airborne. And I would be willing to bet that that's why the caution came out of the trucks, because Gregson lifted off the ground. I think as soon as they see a car go off the ground, they're going to throw a caution every time, just because that's the mindset of NASCAR.
Yeah, and to your point, I mean, no one could catch up with NASCAR after the race, because supposedly, and this is what I was talking to you offline about before Joey called, some of the media members were pissed because they couldn't catch up with NASCAR. So they issued a statement saying, and I quote, "We were closely monitoring each car involved and were actively communicating with spotters and safety trucks in turn one. All cars were able to roll off under their own power or signal they were clear. As always, we make every effort to end under green for our fans in the stands and at home," which we did. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm glad that went green. It was entertaining. Yep. But I understand why Kurt Busch is pissed off for both accounts.
Yep.
But now, if you brought up media, and like I said, the media was, I mean, they were pissed off about, NASCAR kind of leaving the track beforehand, not being able to catch up. And this goes back to, I was talking to Tom Bowles about this, owner of FrontStretch.com, earlier today. It was either New Hampshire or Dover last year. It was after the Chicago incident where Chase Elliott, his team worked on his car after the race or whatever. They worked, I think it was the shark fin. I might be wrong about that, but they worked on his car and they had a camera on it so you could see it. NASCAR didn't penalize him, but what happened was the next week, so it would have been New Hampshire, NASCAR mandated that drivers get out of their cars once the race is over, but they're single file in the outermost lane, playoff drivers in the outermost lane, and they can't come over until they're instructed to do so by officials. Which makes it kind of ridiculous when you're in media. I mean, I'm sure you've had this problem. I've had this problem trying to catch up with them, because some of these drivers don't stick around all the time. And there's, I mean, I know you're suspended from Twitter, which we talked about a couple weeks ago on the podcast, but this was a big talking point this week. And I'm just curious about what your point is about what's the right way of getting a driver after the race.
That has been an irritation point for me for many years, and it continues to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
As more and more drivers have more and more means of getting out of the racetrack faster.
Mm-hmm.
My problem with it stems more of NASCAR letting it happen. Because the bottom line is, we are there to tell NASCAR's story.
Yep.
That is what we're there for. We are there to tell the story of what happened, why it happened, who it happened to, and spread that to the masses. And if NASCAR wants us to do that job, they have to give us access that will let us do that job. And the fact that they do not require these drivers to give us some kind of time at the end of the race is infuriating. And you have a handful that will stick around for a little bit, especially, again, as we point out all the time, the guys that are running for 25th on back, because they're anxious for coverage and they're willing to talk to you. But it just drives me bananas that we don't have, I call it a 15-minute clock or maybe a 10-minute clock, where when the checkered flag flies and they all come on pit lane and they let us over the wall, because there's a rule that is loosely enforced that says we cannot go over the wall until the officials tell us we can go over the wall. But once that moment happens, there needs to be a clock, and whether it's 10 minutes or 15 minutes, that every driver has to stand by their car and be available to the media. And if nobody comes up to talk to you, well, good for you. You just get to relax. But in order for us to tell the story, we need to be able to talk to these guys. And it just drives me crazy. I mean, and one of the examples I've used for a few years now was when Clint Bowyer drove for H. Scott. And he was at that point where he had already kind of given up on the season. And that is a whole other bone of contention. But anyway, we're at Martinsville. Kyle Busch wins the race and is on the front stretch doing his burnouts. Clint Bowyer is already over the wall and walking to his coach in turn four. I mean, we're not even allowed all over the wall yet because Busch is doing his burnouts, and Clint's already walking across the track in turn four to go to his coach. So there was no chance in hell we were going to get a quote from Clint. And it just, I don't know. It drives me crazy because I'm like, if we don't ask the drivers questions and report from other sources, and then it comes out to be not true, they're like, well, why didn't you ask me? Well, because you weren't available. And, you know, they have the media availability in the media center for whatever 8 or 10 drivers they pick on a given weekend. But that doesn't cover them after the races. And they're if NASCAR wants us to tell this story, they need to give us that access, because everybody else, NHRA, IndyCar, I mean, even NBA, MLB, all yeah. those guys, you go into their locker room, those guys are in the locker room and required to yep. be available for 15 minutes. You know, there's a cool down period there where they don't let anybody in the locker room and they do their whatever they do. But they open it up, and they have to be available for 15 minutes. And I don't want to, you know, wave the flag of doom, because everybody's saying that NASCAR's still viable and still strong, but it's slipping, and not making your drivers available to the media and to the fans is not going to make things any better.
Yeah, you came into this blind and you just gave
straight for the rant.
No, you came into this blind and you gave a perfect answer. I agree with pretty much, if not all, of those points. And I'm glad you hit on like the other professional sports, whether it's baseball, football, basketball. Yes, they have a cool down time, and that's the good thing about NASCAR, and I guess you could call racing in general, where they don't have that cool down time. So you get the authentic, real emotion from them after they've just spent 3 hours sweating in a 150 degree cockpit or whatever it might be, wherever the race is. And that's real emotion that tells that story. I'll give an example too. Last weekend at Dover, Kyle Larson was a pretty big story. So I'll just give you my mindset. Usually, whether it's myself or whether I have one or two other people from Front Stretch at the track, we have a list of people that we want to grab after the race, that we want to get an interview with, just quotes from, to do sidebars on. And last week I said, well, I want to do Kyle Larson, because what the hell was up with him? You know, at Dover, he was fastest in practice on single lap, 5-lap, 10-lap, 15-lap average. And after the race, Fox Sports got him for one question. I was there, and the Chevy PR was there, and we got three questions total out of him. So, I mean, there's a story there. There's a story of why did you run so bad?
And, yeah, why were you a bag of hammers?
And granted, he did answer. Like, he stayed for three questions, but he walked off after the third question. He was walking off at the end of it. But, you know, thankful for the time. It got me a story, and he had good quotes. He said he'd rather, you know, drive him to a wall head on, which that's right. A good quote. That's blunt Larson. We like that. Another instance, Kyle Busch. This is a good instance, though. At Bristol, after, if you remember in the race a couple months ago, when he hit everything but the pace car, he stayed after for 15 minutes and talked to everybody, answered every question humbly. And I think Kyle, you know, Kyle gets a lot of slack, but I think he's one of the best of the media. I truly do. Same with Jimmy Johnson. They always answer questions for, you know, 5-10 minutes after the race, if there's people there. And right. That's the thing, yep. If there's people there that are telling that story. So, I don't know. It's a weird scenario, because I feel like NASCAR does need to step in. Maybe there should be a bullpen or something that they get all the drivers in. I don't know. I'm not the sanctioning body, but there's got to be some. And it won't be fixed this year. Maybe it'll be fixed next year. Who knows? But it's a work in progress, and I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait in and see how it goes, Neff.
Yeah, it was, and I always had, when they first started the bullpen thing for qualifying,
yep.
Which ended up going out the window,
yeah.
their complaint was, by the drivers, was that people would drag them to the bullpen, and nobody would want to talk to anybody. And so they were like, why do I come down there and then nobody wants to talk to me?
Yep.
My argument was, let's fix this real easy. I don't know how many of y'all have ever been to Outback. But when you go to Outback and you sign in, they give you this little beeper thing. And when your table's ready, the beeper goes off. Give every one of the PR people one of those beeper things. When we come to the bullpen, if we want to talk to their driver, they hit the little button. Their little beeper thing goes off, and they have to bring the driver to the bullpen. If their beeper thing doesn't go off, then their driver's free to go.
Yeah. That's.
It would work ridiculously simply, and nobody seems to think that that's a good idea.
Qualifying is a whole different story. Qualifying, it's really hard to get drivers because pit road's a mess, you know, behind pit road. And that they usually, as soon as they fail to make this, you know, second or third round of qualifying, they're out.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And don't know where they're at because there's no assigned places for them to line up, and you got teams aren't together or anything, so you got dudes that you got to walk up and down the pit lane a couple times to try to remember where everybody's at, and then when their time comes, you got to try to go and catch them before they're on their way to their hauler, and it's crazy.
Yeah, and then you got to hopefully the PR lets you talk to them. So
right, yeah, then there's that.
Yeah, this probably sounds like a couple media members, a couple friends just bitching, but.
That's what we're doing.
But a lot of it's true. So hopefully it'll be taken care of in the coming weeks, months, years. I mean, you never know with this. But Neff, I want to get out of here talking about Kansas a little bit. We hit on it earlier, but Brad Keselowski, Ryan Blaney, they ran out of fuel at Talladega. So now they're out of the playoff picture right now, 18 and 22 points out respectively. Kyle Larson's 26 out, as we mentioned earlier, and Bowman has to win, which I don't see happening. What do you think going into Kansas? Do you think? I mean, you mentioned Truex is out. You think so? Who's in?
I mean, I feel like Truex. I said this when they announced the whole thing was going to happen. The guys are looking for jobs and trying to sell houses, and there's just so much other stuff that's going on at the same time that you can't be focused. Try as you might to say you're focused, you're not, and I feel like that's biting them. So with him being out, I mean, I feel like Keselowski is all but a layup. I mean,
18 points is a lot, though.
Even on, what's that?
18 points is quite a bit.
It is, but Truex is 18 in.
Yeah.
So, but I feel like Keselowski's going to end up, and we've talked about this before, too, that Paul Wolf is the best strategist in the pit lane.
Yep.
And I think he will end up making up those 18 points or close to those 18 points in the first two stages to where it comes down to where he finishes on the last run. And he'll end up, if he doesn't win, I think he'll end up top five. And then it's going to be a matter of where the other guys slot in. But I feel like Keselowski's the one of that group, assuming Larson doesn't. I still think that'll be the one that'll just blow everybody away if it happens, if Larson turns around and throws it up on the rim and rides the boards all night and ends up winning by, 10 seconds. That would just be hilarious.
And that's what he did in the spring race, although he did get in a crash late with Ryan Blaney, but he came from the back to the front very quickly. And yeah. probably would have won the race had it gone green and had he not gotten in trouble there. But, as far as Keselowski, man, I mean, you look at Darlington, you look at Indy, shouldn't have won either of those races, but Paul Wolf got him to win, or put him in position to win. Las Vegas, the last mile and a half, had one of the best cars, along with Truex, I would say, and he won. Heads up. So I like your pick with Keselowski. Blaney, I mean, I think we both had him out. Either you and me had him out or me and Zach had him out this round. So I don't see him making up 22 points. But who knows? He could if it's chaos. I mean, the last couple of races at Kansas have been absolute chaos. So I don't know. It'll be an interesting race. But enough. We got a doubleheader. The Xfinity Series is back in action. Who you got going to Victory Lane this weekend?
Let me just throw out, by the way, as we mentioned doubleheaders here, that I don't know that we talked about it much in the last 2 weeks. The rumors are getting hotter and heavier about Nashville Fairgrounds Speedway hosting Xfinity and trucks. And don't get me wrong, I would love to see that. I think it'd be a fantastic thing. I would love to see us go back, and I'd love to see more Xfinity truck doubleheaders. But I'm a little chafed about the fact that it's SMI that is pushing this when SMI has a fantastically nice racetrack in North Wilkesboro, North Carolina, that they already own and they could easily put on truck and Xfinity races at with a minor investment in fixing it up. So as much as I love the idea of us running back in Nashville, Marcus Smith, you need to step up, fix up North Wilkesboro, and bring the trucks and Xfinity back to where they started. Now, having said that, we're going Kansas racing. And I'm going to take the cheapest way out I possibly can and say Christopher Bell does it again. Because Christopher Bell is my new bandwagon that I'm on. He is going to be the first guy to have the championship in all three divisions, national divisions.
Bold statement, but I like it.
I'm feeling it's going to happen. And the only way that doesn't happen is if Kyle Busch gets a wild hair up his ass in the next 3 or 4 years and decides to go run for a truck title.
Or if Bell doesn't win it one of the next 2 years in Xfinity.
Yeah, exactly. Cup-wise, man, that's a tough call because there's some teams that have just been running like Dookie that you expect to be up top. Let's just go out on a crazy limb and say Clint Bowyer gets it done. Because I think it's going to be a Stewart Haas car, and everybody's kind of thinking Clint's the one of the four that might not make it. So let's give a shout-out to Clint. Say he goes out there and takes the win to be the third car to advance.
He would party like no tomorrow if he wanted his home track.
Yeah, they'll burn down Emporia, Kansas.
Yeah, they'll burn down the grandstand. For Xfinity, for me, Christopher Bell is the layup. I mean, this is where he got his first win in the series last year, and he was only winning a partial schedule. So that's a good call. I'm going to go – I could go Allgaier, and that'd be an easy layup too. I'm going to go with our last week's podcast because I go Daniel Hemric.
Nice.
I say that because, first of all, I truly believe he needs to win and to win the championship. But you look at, like, the Xfinity Series, in my opinion, and I cover the series, I'm the beat writer for it, so I'm a little biased towards the series, but I think it's been some of the best racing all year. But when you look at that, you have Bell winning 6 races, Allgaier winning 5, Ross won 1, Tyler Reddick won 1, a couple part-timers have won a couple, but, man, like, the top guys who had a hell of a points battle, even going down to the last couple weeks of the regular season, they haven't won. When you talk about Cole Custer, Daniel Hemric, Elliott Sadler, none of them have won this year. So we got 4 races left. the Final Four, you know, getting into that race at Homestead is going to be quite interesting over these next three races. So I'll go Hemric. I'll say Hemric. I mean, that would lock himself into Homestead. So I'll say the 21 team. As for Cup, I think it could be an interesting race. I got to go Stuart Haas. I was going to go Harvick. He won there in the spring. He's always good there. But I'm going to go Almirola. I say he goes back to
nice.
I say he goes back to back. This was one of his better tracks with Richard Petty Motorsports. Probably should have won a race here in 12 or 13. I'm not sure of the year. But led a bunch of laps. I say Almirola goes back to back and puts a statement going into the round of eight.
Wow. That would be phenomenal.
Yeah. I mean, he's lost probably three or four that he should have won. Well, start making up for him, I guess. But enough. Any final thoughts before we sign off?
Wow. Almirola wins the championship. Wouldn't that be bananas? Imagine those storylines. Almirola takes the 10 and wins the title.
I mean, you look at this, though, right? Like, Almirola was the 11 seed going into the round of 8, or round of 12. Chase was the 9 seed, and they're both in. So those are, you could call them Cinderella stories, I guess. Underdogs, whatever you want to call them, dark horses. But they're in the round of 8, so there's been two upsets already. I mean, maybe Larson could be a third. He was the 10 seed going into the playoffs, into this round. So, I mean, who knows?
Yeah, I just, Almirola winning the title, though, that would be, what a phenomenal story that would be. To have, especially when you got Harvick and Busch dominating for the whole year, if it turned around that somebody like Almirola came in there with a couple wins and took it, that'd be pretty neat. I don't know. I'm excited because Kansas is an elimination race. Otherwise, it's Kansas. I never get that excited for Kansas. I don't know why this race, for whatever reason, always seems to get a good number. And I've never understood it because it just doesn't seem like it's that exciting of a race most times. But at the same time, you never know. That's the beauty of stock car racing, is it may go out there and be an absolute barn burner to make up for what was an absolute stinker at Talladega. So I'm anxious to see who's fast in practice and to see if it translates into the race. And I'm anxious to see that we have decent weather, because I'm tired of rain, because I've been dealing with a lot of rain in the last couple weeks here. And hopefully we will have good weather and a great race to lead us into the Final Four. Because, man, I can't believe we're looking at being down to the last four races of the season.
Yep.
It seems like just yesterday Almirola was getting wrecked out at Daytona.
Agreed. Yeah, it was 8 months ago. So, very interesting year, but that'll wrap up this week's podcast. Thanks as always for tuning in. And until next week's show, where we review Kansas and preview Martinsville, which Neff and I will both be at, we out.
Peace out.